I'd like to welcome you all to Jersey State University and to the city of Atlanta. We hope that you have a wonderful time while you're here. And I have a few short announcements to make and a slight presentation with Mr. Barbara, and then we'll be on our way. The first piece of news that you need to know is there's no smoking allowed in any building on the Jersey State University campus. The second thing that you need to know is that in this hall and in the lobby, no food and drink can be consumed. Okay? Sorry about that, but I need to tell you, they say they have ants in the carpet, and until they get rid of the ants, there's no food and drink allowed. Third thing I need to tell you is the Anthony's Auto and Music Museum tour was canceled because we did not get enough people to make the minimum. Refunds are being processed and will be mailed back to you at your address. Fourth thing, any speakers who are using slides this morning need to see me. We're using a rear projection screen and we have to reverse them to make them show properly. And that's my list of announcements. We're fortunate to have today a letter of welcome from the mayor of the city of Atlanta to the Association for Recorded Sound Collections, and it'll be on display in the lobby for you to read. I won't read the whole thing right now. But the last paragraph is, on behalf of the citizens of Atlanta, I welcome you to our beautiful city. We have developed a long-established reputation for Southern hospitality, and we hope that all members of the Association for Recorded Sound Collections will have an opportunity to share our enthusiasm for one of America's most progressive cities. Over.
Thank you, Chris. On behalf of the Association for Recorded Sound Collections, we're pleased to be in Atlanta. I speak for all of us in saying that if our welcome last night at the reception and the time that we spent, those of us who've been here for a day or so far in the city, is any indication, then we're in for a wonderful few days in the course of our conference here. So thanks very much to Chris and to all of her colleagues who are helping to put this on. We're very much looking forward to it, and so far so good. I think we'll have a wonderful time. As you all know, this is an election year. You should have received ballots in your registration packet. And in accordance with bylaws covering certification of elections, we're required to elect three inspectors of elections in order to get the ballot counted. And so in order to do that, at this time, as president of ARC, I call to order our 25th annual business meeting for the express purpose of electing the inspectors of elections. We will do this very shortly and get it done, and then we'll move on to the meeting, to the conference itself. The bylaws also state that one-third of the total number of members in good standing in attendance at the meeting shall constitute a quorum for transaction of business. And I think that looking around the room and knowing what our registration is, that I declare that we have a quorum here. For your information, so you'll know how to go about this, nominees must be members who are neither candidates for nor holders of the offices to be filled. So they can be neither candidates, obviously, who are running or people who currently hold those offices. So given that, I will now entertain nominations from the floor. And nominees for inspectors of elections head. Don McCormick has been nominated. No, but the office being elected is first vice president-elect, so there's no conflict there. Any other nominees, please? Steve. Fred Williams. Elwood. Harold Heckendorf has been nominated. All right, thank you. It has been moved and seconded the nomination closed. All in favor of closing nominations? Any opposed? The nominations are closed. Do I hear a motion to elect if we have only three nominees? Sure. I have both a motion and a second that we elect by acclamation, essentially. Are there any? We'll have to vote. All those in favor of electing, say aye. Opposed? We now have our three inspectors of election. Thank you very much. They are Don McCormick. Let me remind people, they are Don McCormick, Fred Williams, and Harold Heckendorf. We thank them very much for taking on this task. As you've heard, Phil Rocklin has the ballots, and sometime in the next day or so, we'll get them counted so that we can then have the results of the election. We're right on time. How do you like that? I'm not going to take any more of your time. Do have a good time this next 3 days, and I'm sure we'll all have a wonderful time here again.
Thanks, Barbara, and excuse me. And thank you so much for all of the work that you've done this past year, not only in behalf of the organization, but in working alongside me to get this program put together. I'm Dick Spotswood. I'm your second vice president and program chairman for this event. Special thanks also to Chris Hayden, whose efforts in our behalf have been all too obvious in the form of the lovely facilities he's found for us, the high quality of support and invitation to Atlanta in the first place. I thought it especially appropriate that we have an Atlanta resident who's made a major literary contribution in the past year in the form of a book called Pickin' on Peachtree, which deals with the history of country music in Atlanta itself. And as you know, the recording industry drew very, very heavily on the talent, not just from Atlanta, but from the surrounding regions of Central and North Georgia for many of its early hillbilly and so-called race record recording stars. Atlanta was a very, very important early recording center from the time that Ralph Peer first visited the city on behalf of Polk Brockman in 1923 and recorded Fiddling John Carson's very first titles. Wayne Daniel teaches at CSU, and his book, Pickin' on Peachtree, has garnered any number of favorable reviews since it was published for University of Illinois just about 1 year ago. And he very kindly consented to come and talk to us this morning. When are we close by time? Fortunately, we're right on time, and one or two things may take us a little bit over, but with generous time allotted for breaks and for lunch today, we should be okay. We'll try to keep on schedule as much as possible. Please make Dr. Wayne Daniel welcome.
Thank you, Dick, and good morning. I would like to add my welcome to you all to Georgia State University. We're pleased to have you here. And just as soon as I see where the arrow is going here, as Dick told you, my talk is based on my book, Pickin' on Peachtree. You may have already seen Peachtree Street since you've been in Atlanta. It runs right down the middle of town. The subtitle is The History of Country Music in Atlanta, Georgia. And if you were like most people I've met and talked to about this book during the past year, you didn't even know Atlanta had a history of country music. Well, some of the events that Atlanta claims title to is being the scene of the first real country music record. It was recorded here in 1923. Fiddling John Carson, an Atlanta fiddler, was the artist on that record. It was the title of the record. On one side was Little Old Log Cabin in the Lane. On the other side was The Old Hen Cackle and The Rooster's Going to Crow. Atlanta is supposed to be the first, the home of the first radio station to use true country music artists. Within about a week after WSB went on the air in 1922, and then John Carson again went down to the studio and asked to have an opportunity to perform on WSB. He was given that opportunity, and for several years thereafter, he was one of the most popular artists on WSB radio. Atlanta was the scene of the recording of the first woman country music vocalist, the first woman who made a country music record primarily for her vocal ability. There was a country music artist, woman artist, who recorded prior to her, but she was primarily an instrumentalist. This was Roba Stanley, who is now referred to as the first sweetheart of country music. As far as I have been able to tell, and I've consulted with several record collectors and discographers around the country, Atlanta appears to be the scene of the first recording of You Are My Sunshine. This was recorded in 1939 at the Kimball House Hotel. All that's left of the Kimball House Hotel is the bar. And it resides in the Kimball House Restaurant, which is just up Decatur Street here. So if you walk west on Decatur Street, which Decatur Street is the next street over, if you walk west, you'll see the Kimball House Restaurant on your left, about two blocks up from here. And that was the block in which the Kimball House Hotel was located, which was the scene of numerous field recording sessions in the 20s and 30s. During the 20s and 30s, Atlanta was the premier field recording center. The record companies from New York brought their field recording equipment here to Atlanta and recorded numerous sessions, not only of Atlanta artists, but of musicians from surrounding states, Alabama, Mississippi, Kentucky, Tennessee, North and South Carolina. Atlanta was home to the first documented case of a string band using the term hillbilly as part of its name. This was George Daniel's Hillbillies. They performed on WSB in the 20s, and they went on the air just after the record was made by the group that also called themselves Hillbillies. But my research seems to show that they had the name Hillbillies long before the group who recorded under the name Hillbillies, and therefore has received credit for being the band that named the music. But I contend that it was George Daniel's Hillbillies. What I have this morning are some samples of recorded music from Atlanta area artists who recorded in the 20s and 30s. This, in essence, is a sample of a sample. I can only give you samples of recordings that were made, but not all of Atlanta's country music artists ever recorded. More didn't record, of course, than did. So we perhaps can infer that those who didn't record were sounded pretty much like the ones who did record, except possibly not as good. Okay? And I also have some slides, but I understand that the stage lights are so bright that you may not be able to see the slides very well, but I apologize for that. My history of country music begins in 1913. That's when the Fiddler's Convention were first documented in the Atlanta newspapers. In 1913, That was the Federalist Convention here in Atlanta. Presumably not the first, but it was the first to receive extensive coverage, or perhaps any coverage at all, by the Atlanta newspapers. This Federalist Convention was held in the old City Auditorium. The City Auditorium was one block east of here, about 10 years ago, the auditorium was torn down. All that's left is the front part of the building, which at that time were offices of some sort. And it now houses Georgia State Alumni Hall and other university offices. You can, those of you who are familiar with the old Federalist Conventions that were held in Atlanta beginning in 1913, will recall a place called Taft Hall. That was the room in front of the auditorium where the Fiddlers went after the convention sessions were over to have their square dances. Taft Hall was named in honor of President Taft, who visited Atlanta while he was president and made a speech. And the room carried his name up until Georgia State acquired the building. The room is now called Veterans Memorial Hall. So if any of you are Fiddlers and have any desire to see where the Fiddlers fiddled after the conventions were over, you can walk into the front of the building. It's the first room on your right, that's half hall. You'll be surprised, as I was, at how small it was. In reading the newspaper coverage of the square dances that were held after the Federalist Conventions, I had visions of a room at least this big, and then when I went to look, it was much, much smaller. The Federalist Conventions had been going on in Atlanta, I understand, prior to 1913, but in 1913 they received extensive coverage from the newspapers, and also in 1913 the Fiddlers organized themselves into somewhat of a formal organization called the Georgia Old Time Fiddlers Association. They elected officers that year in 1913 and held a Fiddlers Convention at least annually until 1935, except for one year. There's one year in there, 1933 or 34, that we can't find any documentation of there having been a convention that year. But they held forth all those years. And all the conventions were held at the City Auditorium. Some of the fiddlers who participated in those contests did record, not all of them, of course, but several. Gid Tanner recorded, Sidney John Carson recorded, Clayton McNichan recorded, and several others. The person who recorded, rather, who won the Fiddler's Contest more than any other contestant was A.A. Gray from Tallapoosa, Georgia. And he probably recorded fewer slides than any of the other fiddlers who recorded. He won the contest about 8 times, more than any other Georgia fiddler. And we will see what his group looked like. He was a member of a band called called A.A. Gray's String Band, which operated out of Tallapoosa. He came to Atlanta every year to enter the Fiddler's Contest. We'll see what his band looked like and hear what one of his records sounded like. So let's see if I can get all this to work. This is supposed to turn on the slide, and it did. There's the first slide. Now let's see if we can hear it. So I suppose that that's what the Fiddler's Convention sounded like for all those years. Women in country music began with Roba Stanley. She lived in Gwinnett County, which is two counties removed from the county in which we are now standing. Gwinnett County is northeast of here. Her father was a fiddler, and he won at least one Fiddler's Convention, and he participated in several of them as a contestant. She was about 14 years old when her father decided that it was time that she became a recording artist. And he brought her to Atlanta to one of the field recording sessions, and she auditioned and made some records, about 8 or 10 sides, perhaps more. Singing the songs that were standard back in those days. She recorded one that is far ahead of its time as far as a statement of women's liberation is concerned. And you'll, I hope you'll be able to hear the word well enough to see that. She performed on WSB radio several times with her father and a string band that he had organized. But she, although in the song that you're about to hear, she says that she will never get married. A couple of years after her recording session, she did get married and moved to Florida, and that was the end of her recording career until some researchers in the history of country music discovered her living in Florida and got her to tell her story. She was recognized at the Grand Ole Opry one night as a member of the audience, as the first woman country music artist. So here is Roba Stanley singing Single Girl. Shouldn't I be able to get sound if I press pause again? Pardon? Gospel music was, of course, a popular type of music in Atlanta when radio came to the city in 1922. And it just so happened that one of the Atlanta Journal's leading newsboys was a gospel singer and an evangelist. The Atlanta Journal, by the way, owned WSB and put it on the air in 1922, and the newsboy was Andrew Jenkins, Reverend Andrew Jenkins, who had a wife and two stepdaughters who were musicians, and he became fascinated by this new thing called radio, and was soon performing on WSB with the Reverend Andrew Jenkins family. Mainly it was him and his two stepdaughters who performed. He was blind. He not only recorded as a gospel performer, but as Blind Andy, a fiddler. He was a talented musician who played several instruments. So many of you are into country music record collecting. You are probably familiar with the Blind Dandy recording. He also recorded under a couple of other names, I think. And his stepdaughters were Irene Spang, and there's some records under her name also. And his other daughter is still living. She, of course, is dead, and so is the older daughter, Irene Spang. They recorded many, many records beginning about 1925 until the mid-30s. So let's see what the Andrew Jenkins family looked like and sounded like. Programming for radio in those early days was a developing art, to say the least. One of the daughters told me that they would be in bed asleep at 10 o'clock at night or later, and they'd get a call from WSB saying, "Please come down, we need you. We've run out of people to perform on the late night show." They would get out of bed, catch the streetcar, and come down to town and to do a song on the radio, and didn't even get paid for it. But they did get exposure, and it helped their record sales, presumably, and they did some concerts and church things. The first real commercial country music record was made in 1923 by Fiddler John Carson, who had already established himself as a popular fiddler at the convention. They'd been going on 10 years now, at least, since 1913. And he had established himself as a major attraction on WSB radio. So he, Polk Brockman, a furniture dealer here, made arrangements to have him recorded so that he would get some records that he could sell in his furniture store. Young people find it hard to believe that you used to buy your records at furniture stores, so if all of you know that. They can't believe it. Sometimes I talk to students in the commercial music department here at Georgia State, and when I say they bought their records at the furniture store, they think I have a typographical error in my speech. Fiddlin' John's record was on one side, Little Old Log Cabin in the Lane, and that's what we're about to hear, and The Old Hen Cackle and Rooster's Going to Crow on the other. So here is okay, that's Fiddlin' John Carson and his daughter, who went by the name Moonshine Kate. And that's their Silver Eagle Bus. That's the touring car. It says Sidney John Carson Moonshine Kate, and somewhere on that it says recording audio. You see that? Okay. Well, here is Sidney John Carson. There was a network among these artists, hillbilly artists, back in the 20s and 30s, and there was a connection between Fiddlin' John Carson, who was known for his association with liquor sales and bootlegging and that sort of activity, as well as his willingness to taste his own wares without much motivation. And he was well acquainted with the Reverend Andrew Jenkins family. In fact, one of the daughters, stepdaughters of Andrew Jenkins, was a trained musician. She could write music and could transcribe music from listening to a record. And one of the things that Polk Brockman had her do was to transcribe Fiddlin' John Carson's records so they could sell the sheet music and sell the songs and songbooks and that sort of thing. And she told one interviewer about how embarrassed she was at some of the lyrics of Fiddlin' John Carson's song. And she said that he was always half drunk, it seems, and that he had special trouble transcribing the words to his songs because it sounded like he had two jawbreakers in his mouth when he sang. I think she perhaps was exaggerating. Andrew Jenkins was a blind man, as I think I said before, and is one of several blind country music artists who performed in Atlanta. Another one was Riley Puckett. How many of you are into country music collecting? Okay, so you all know who Riley Puckett is. He is a blind man. Riley Puckett performed at the Fiddler's Convention. He was frequently there. He was not a fiddler, but he was there to sing and to play the banjo. And he was billed as the Bald Mountain Caruso. Another blind musician, we'll hear from him shortly. The last blind country musician who at one time called Atlanta home is still performing. Who's the blind country musician now? Who? No. Yeah, Ronnie Millsap. Right. Ronnie Millsap was a student of Governor Val Miller's when Governor Miller taught at John Harris College. And Ronnie came to Atlanta in the 60s, I guess it was, and formed his nightclub here and lived here in Atlanta. He was living in Atlanta when he was evicted from his apartment for not being able to pay his rent. The most famous group probably to come out of Atlanta in those early days was a string band called the Skillet Lickers. The name most frequently associated with the Skillet Lickers was a man by the name of Gid Tanner, and the records used to say Gid Tanner and the Skillet Lickers, and some of them will say with Clayton McNichan, and some will say with Riley Puckett, and I think some even say with Clayton McNichan and Riley Puckett have both labels. I don't think those musicians got along together very well. Clayton McNichan said that Gid Tanner couldn't play the fiddle, was too rusty, too old timey. Clayton McNichan was a more progressive artist, a more polished artist, at least in his own eyes. So Clayton McMichan has said that those records would not have sold if it hadn't been for Riley Puckett singing. They started recording about 1925 and recorded until the nuclear group, the original group, more or less. An original string band doesn't last very long, but because of so much personnel turnover, but they recorded until the very early 30s. Then in 1936, the most famous song to be recorded by the group was recorded in Texas, and it was Down Yonder, and it was issued as by Gid Tanner and the Skillet Lickers, and everybody presumed, unless they know better, that Gid Tanner was doing the fiddling on that, but as it so happens, it was his son, Gordon Tanner, who was doing the fiddling on that record. That was their bestseller. Gid Tanner, of course, is dead. Gordon is now dead. His son, Phil, still lives in Gwinnett County, the same county that gave us Robert Stanley. Phil is a fiddler, and Phil's son is a fiddler, so there are at least four generations of fiddlers in that family, and Phil and his son still perform. They have a band called the Junior Skillet Lickers, and they're still performing. So let's hear, some of you collectors would probably have preferred to hear one of the earlier Gid Tanner recordings, but I decided to play their a record from their last session in 1936, and this is Down Yonder. So let's see what we have here. We have here a picture of Gid Tanner on the right. He's on your right. That's Gid Tanner. On your left is fiddling John Carson. Gid Tanner was probably not a very good fiddler. I'm not a musician, but musicians tell me that he was not as good a fiddler as most of the other fiddlers around. He was a comedian, a great comedian, and he did a lot of comedy on his stage shows and at the fiddler's conventions, and he was famous for his imitations of people around Atlanta. I don't know what those imitations sounded like because they were not put on record. But he was more of a comedian than he was a musician. His son turned out to be a better musician than he was. So here is the Skillet Lickers, and you will hear Riley Prickett was known not only as a singer, but as a guitarist. He was a much emulated guitarist, famous for his bass runs on the guitar, and you'll get to hear some of the bass runs on this selection. So here we go. Good Tenor and the Skillet Lickers, Down Yonder, 1936, made in Dallas, Texas. A great deal of controversy surrounds the composition of You Are My Sunshine, one of the most popular and best known country music songs ever to come down the pipe, as they say. One of the first crossover country music songs. I interviewed several people who recorded You Are My Sunshine and who were present when the song was being evolved. Paul Rice, who was a hillbilly performer in Atlanta, told me that he was given the song, he received a letter from a fan. It was several pages long, in which she told him how he was her sunshine and that sort of thing. And he claims that that was the inspiration for his writing the song, You Are My Sunshine. He and his brother performed with a group called the Rice Brothers. They were performing on WSB in Atlanta about that time. This was about 1939. When the song seems to have been sung. I interviewed Paul. He sold the song. Whoever wrote the song, he happened to have a copy of the words in about 1940, and he sold the words allegedly for $35 to Jimmy Davis. Paul had moved on to Freeport, Louisiana, and was performing on a radio station there at the time. And he showed me, when I interviewed him, a newspaper clipping from a Freeport newspaper where a feature writer had written about You Are My Sunshine and said that Jimmy Davis paid $35 for it so Paul could get his wife out of the hospital. Paul told me to I didn't sell that song for $35. I got $50 for the song. Jimmy Davis, of course, made one of the best-selling recordings of the song. It was also recorded by Wayne King and by Bing Crosby. It was recorded by, documentation of it being recorded that I could locate by two fellows called the Pine Ridge Boys, Marvin Taylor and Doug Spivey, who were performing at WSB at the time. Marvin Taylor had passed away when I was doing my research, but Doug Spivey was still living. He has since passed away. I interviewed him, and he said that the way he came to the song was that there was a string band from South Carolina had come to Atlanta to do a stage show, and as part of their promotion, they were doing a spot on WPST, another radio station here in Atlanta. And he happened to be in the studio at the time, and they had a girl singer who sang You Are My Sunshine, and he struck up a conversation with her, and she gave him the song. She said, here, I wrote this song, you can have it, and do whatever you want to with it. So he and Marvin Taylor, under the name Pine Ridge Boys, recorded it in 1939, about a month before the Rice Brothers recorded it. So as far as I can tell, they were the first ones to record You Are My Sunshine. Bob Asher, a Kentucky hillbilly artist, also recorded the song, I think possibly before Jimmy Davis did. Anyway, we're going to hear what I believe to be the first recording ever of You Are My Sunshine. The Pine Ridge Boys, Marvin Taylor and Doug Spivey, performed with a group called Pop Eckler and His Young'un. They performed on WSB in Atlanta. And Marvin and Doug are the second and third from your right. Doug Spivey is second from the right. Marvin Taylor third from the right. Marvin was from the Macon, Georgia area, and Doug originally was from North Georgia, but came to Atlanta when he was a teenager, and they met when they became members of this group, Pop Eckler and His Young'un. And Pop Eckler, who is on the extreme right, who is one of numerous Kentucky artists who came down to Atlanta to make their name in radio. And they recorded quite a number of songs. And you'll hear them yodeling on this song, and this may be the only record, correct me if I'm wrong, in which there's yodeling on You Are My Sunshine. Does anybody know of another recording of You Are My Sunshine that has yodeling on it? Okay, so this may be the first, the only recording of You Are My Sunshine that has yodeling. So let's see what it sounds like. Pine Ridge Boys performed a style that is known as brother duet style. Although they weren't brothers, their performance was along that line. One of the most famous brother duets ever, and brother duets were really big in the 30s and early 40s in country music. You have the Delmore Brothers, the Callahan Brothers, Carlisle Brothers, numerous other brother acts. But one of the most influential brother act for the Blue Sky Boys. Originally from North Carolina, they came to Georgia about 1935, came to Atlanta, and performed not on the most powerful station in Atlanta, but on a secondary station as far as power went, WGST. They were called the Blue Sky Boys. They recorded extensively. One played a mandolin, one played a guitar, which was the typical instrumentation of the brothers duet. The biggest selling song was a song called Kentucky. Kentucky's getting an awful lot of recognition in this talk. But their theme song was a song called Are You From Dixie? And this is the song that brought them on the radio every day and took them off when their program was finished. The Blue Sky Boys. Bill and Earl Bowling. They're both still living. Bill, the one with the mandolin, lives in Hickory, North Carolina. They retired from music in the 50s, and Bill went to work for the post office in Hickory, North Carolina. Earl now lives in Suwanee, Georgia, which is about 30 miles up the road here. When he got out of the music business, he went to work with Lockheed Aircraft Corporation plant in Marietta, Georgia, and worked there until he retired. So here they are, the Blue Sky Boys, singing their theme song. In 1940, the Atlanta Journal and WSB Radio, well, actually this took place in 1939. In 1939, the newspaper and the radio station were sold to the Cox Newspaper Enterprises out of Ohio. And the Atlanta Journal became a Cox newspaper. And one of the things that the people who took charge of WSB Radio at that time wanted done was to revamp the hillbilly programming on the station. So they called in John Lair from where else, Kentucky, to come down to Atlanta and set up a hillbilly programming format for WSB. John Lair had established himself as a hillbilly entrepreneur in Chicago and in Kentucky. So one of the things that John Lair did was to start a Saturday night barn band, which was a Grand Ole Opry type show, a stage show with live broadcasting direct from the stage over the radio station. He brought people from Kentucky down to be performers on the station. He fired a lot of the artists who had been performing on WSB up until that time. And he got artists from various other places. And the WSB Barn Dance became one of the most popular shows on WSB radio. During at least one rating period in the 50s, it went off the air, in the 40s rather, it went off the air in 1950. But during one of the rating periods in the 1940s, it was the number one listened to program on WSB or any other station in Atlanta. It was the had the top rating in Atlanta. Unfortunately, it kind of got a late start as far as barn dance act programs were concerned, and could not achieve the momentum to endure as long as the Grand Ole Opry did. But it was a similar type show. One of the artists on the WSB Barn Dance, one of the most popular artists, was the other blind singer, Hillbilly Singer, who was from the Atlanta area. His name was Pete Castle. He was a crooner type singer, kind of a pre-80 Arnold type singer. Jack Green, who is a country music artist who had a lot of big country hits in the 60s and who is a member of the Grand Ole Opry, he told me that when he was growing up in Maryville, Tennessee, which is in the Blue Ridge Mountains near Gatlinburg, as some of you may know, due to the geography of the region and the physics of radio transmission, he was not able to pick up the Grand Ole Opry on his radio, but he could pick up the WSB Barn Dance. So he got his inspiration mainly from the WSB Barn Dance. And his favorite artist was Pete Castle, the man that you're about to hear. And one of Pete Castle's most popular songs was a song called The Last Letter. And it was the first hit for Jack Green many years later. The song we're going to hear Pete Castle do now is a song called Freight Train Blues, authorship of which is credited to John Lair from Kentucky. So let's see what Pete Castle, blind Pete Castle, he is now deceased, and here is his rendition of, partial rendition of Freight Train Blues.
Now I was born to see him the boomer's side, just a loose end he filed the roadside. The knocking of the driver was my lullaby, and the freight train whistle taught me how to ride. I've got freight train blues, lordy, lordy, lordy. Got them in the bottoms of my gun. When the whistle blows, I gotta go. Oh, Lordy, guess I'm never gonna lose the freight train blues.
Okay, that's what country music fans in the Atlanta area were listening to on their phonographs and their radios and at the Fiddler's Conventions and other country music stage shows between 1913 and 1950. If you want to know more about the subject, you can find out all about it in a book called Picking on Peachtree, A History of Country Music in Atlanta. I understand there's some copies in the Georgia State University bookstore, and B. Dalton down the street at Five Points also has a couple of copies. Are there any questions? Well, thank you. Yes. That is correct. honestly don't know, unless it was because that was the year that they decided to formally organize into a convention, and they may have let this be known to the newspapers, and that may have motivated. I've wondered the same thing myself, and I have not been able to find any documentation of why that year happened to be the one. And that's the only explanation that I can give. Yes. Well, the fiddlers would probably say that the best talent was in this part of the country. Well, it was according to the press, it was an extremely colorful event. And early 20th century newspaper writers had a field of it. And it's hard to separate exaggeration from facts when you read these newspaper accounts. And they were extremely extensive. I have a stack of clippings that high that covers the period. And they would start 2 weeks in advance of the convention and type it up. And unfortunately, they didn't cover it afterwards as much as we would have liked, so we don't always know who won second, third, fourth, and fifth place. But it was a colorful event. They talked about these people coming down out of the mountains with their long beards and their homemade clothes and their fiddles and gunny sacks and bringing their hound dogs and their fried chicken on the train and getting lost on Decatur Street and Peachtree Street. Speaking of Decatur Street is famous in a lot of musical genres, including country music, blues and jazz. I guess you hear a lot about it. Decatur Street is one block over, and it doesn't look like it did back then, though. So it was a colorful event, and there were three newspapers in Atlanta at the time, the Atlanta Journal, the Atlanta Constitution, and the Atlanta Georgian, and all three of them wrote extensively, all except one, possibly, of those traditions. Thank goodness they did it. Any other questions? All right, well, thank you very much, and again, welcome to Atlanta.